Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights and Litigation Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, February 24, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on today's Supreme Court oral argument and Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA, also known as the greenhouse gas cases. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. And also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome Mr. Robert Gassaway, partner at Kirkland & Ellis. A more complete bio for Mr. Gassaway was provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. Mr. Gassaway, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thanks, first of all, to the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate in this event. I hope I can briefly give a little bit of background on the case, give a summary of some of the more important, from my standpoint, questions and answers that we saw today during the oral argument, and then throw it open for questions, and I hope for comments as well. It was a good turnout at the court this morning. There were a number of lawyers there who have been very involved in this wide-ranging case, and I'm hoping one or more of them might have called in and be able to offer their perspectives on the proceedings this morning. I know that probably a lot of our listeners are very familiar with the case, but I think a little bit of background may be helpful to start with. It was described as the greenhouse gas case, but it's even more particular than that. This is what I would call the PSD and Title V applicability case. And the fundamental question before the court today was whether the Prevention of Significant Deterioration Program of the Clean Air Act applies to GHGs, and if so, how. That is the program that requires substantive case-by-case permitting for what was intended to be large sources of pollutants, sources that put out either 100 or 250 tons per year. That was extended to encompass GHGs in early 2009. And then by virtue of that extension to PSD, the Title V Operating Permit Program of the Clean Air Act was also extended to encompass GHGs. One of the main consequences of these extensions were that the number of sources encompassed with the program became much, much larger. It was originally just a few hundred per year, new and modified sources for PSD. That expanded from something like 300 a year to 80,000 once they're extended to GHGs. Title V would go up to approximately 6 million. In order to prevent the substantive extension of the act to many more sources, including small sources, and also in order administratively to prevent the case-by-case permitting authorities at the state and local level from getting swamped, EPA did in the rulemaking below what they called a tailoring of the statute, and they took the numerical cut points that were objectively enacted by Congress. They changed those from 100 and 250 to essentially 75,000 and 100,000 pollutants. And they did that on authority of a number of different doctrines, including the so-called absurdity doctrine and the so-called administrative necessity doctrine. And those doctrines were a focus of the arguments today. The other thing I'd like to point out is that there were basically three possible outcomes of the case today. One obviously would be a clear win for EPA, and that would affirm the EPA regulations as they were affirmed in the D.C. Circuit. The EPA regulations were on the order of saying we can apply the PSD program to GHGs. We're going to temporarily rewrite or tailor the thresholds so that only an approximation of the large sources that would originally have been encompassed within the program are encompassed with the program. But over time, we're going to change those numerical thresholds, and we're going to try to extend them to as many sources as we think would be worthy of regulation. And it was unclear to me at the rulemaking, and even unclear to me after the argument today, what that ultimate goal of that extension would be as they changed the program over time. But that was the EPA position. Diametrically opposed to that position was what was described as the principal argument in a joint reply brief that was submitted by four of the six petitioners. And that principal argument was the just say no argument. It just said that the PSD and by extension the Title V programs just do not apply in any form to greenhouse gases, simple and clean. Then there was a secondary argument, an alternative argument or fallback argument as described in that brief, that was something of a middle position, which essentially took the position that if a facility, a new or modified facility, has to apply for and obtain a PSD license in any event because of its emissions of conventional pollutants that have long been regulated, then that facility can also be regulated for purposes of controlling its GHG emissions. So under this middle ground argument, and it comes in various flavors, there would be no new facilities subjected to the PSD requirements, but there would be new requirements for facilities already subject to PSD. The argument was very lively this morning. There were a couple of unusual twists to the argument. One was just that the time was extended by the Chief Justice for both sides. It was supposed to be 45 minutes per side, and when the petitioner side was arguing, Chief Justice Roberts gave five additional minutes to Peter Keisler, who was the principal arguer, having originally 30 of those 45 minutes. And then on the bottom side, he gave five additional minutes to the Solicitor General, Mr. Verrilli. The argument was handled for petitioners, and I may say very ably handled for petitioners, by Mr. Keisler and by Jonathan Mitchell, the Solicitor General of the state of Texas, who was arguing on behalf of about a dozen states. Again, it was a very lively argument. I think what I will do instead of doing a blow-by-blow is just take a step back. I've listed, and I try to do this in encapsulating many arguments, a top five or so Q's and A's that kind of give you a flavor of where the court and maybe particular justices are thinking, and then maybe a little bit of bottom line analysis, and then we can throw it open to questions and further comments by attendees. So one of the things that I thought was very characteristic of the court was a couple of comments that I'm going to be synthesizing here by Justice Kagan. Justice Kagan opened the argument by noting that there were a number of different positions here. There were a couple of these intermediate positions that would take the court to a destination where no new facilities could be regulated, but that the existing facilities regulated in any event could have to apply with GHG controls. One of those was in the ACC argument. One of those was set forth very eloquently in a dissenting opinion from denial en banc below by Judge Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit. And then Judge Kagan noticed in the briefing for the Roman numeral one argument that would just say no to GHG. Different that there were different things that could be emphasized for that. So in Justice Kagan's view, what she was trying to do is say that there's a lot of confusion here. There are obviously a lot of different interpretations on the petitioner's side. And so in her words, this should be the, quote, apex of Chevron deference. There is a new kind of pollutant. It seemed to her that this was, quote, a classic case of Chevron deference, and this would be a case in which the agency, the expert agency, here EPA, could, quote, choose how to make it work. So that was one strand of argument from Justice Kagan that was directed to the petitioners. Obviously, the petitioner's comeback had to do with some fairly sophisticated statutory interpretation arguments that were presented in defense of why EPA did not have deference to extend the PSD program to GHGs. A variant on that theme, I thought, came through from Justice Breyer, and this is the what I call the "What Would Congress Do" hypothetical, as is sometimes the case in oral arguments at the Supreme Court. Justice Breyer was willing to spin out this hypothetical at some length in a question to Jonathan Mitchell of the state of Texas. And the basic premise of it was the Congress and the congressmen that were active in putting the PSD statute in place in the 1977 amendment were not specifically thinking about this type of pollutant, greenhouse gases, but now that it's on the scene, there are basically two alternatives to dealing with them. One is to exclude them and the regulation of GHGs from the PSD statutes altogether. And the other alternative is to, in some sense, make implicit exceptions or otherwise make the statute work as best as it can rather than excluding them altogether. Option one, option two, what would they do? General Mitchell, I thought, was very strong in his response, saying clearly option one should be preferred here. Justice Breyer said laughingly, "I thought that what you would say." But the point of the interchange was just if you look at it from some people's angle, and certainly from the EPA's angle, a categorical exclusion of GHGs might seem more far-reaching than even the tailoring of the statutory thresholds and the numerical limits that EPA engaged in, although I thought General Mitchell had good answers for that. Sort of coming at it from a different perspective, I would say, would be some of the questions from Justice Alito. And there were two that struck me this morning from him. He pointed out that there was, in his view, what I'll call a tension, I'm not sure he used that word, between EPA's argument that it needed to redraw the dividing line in terms of number of tons, separating those that would be regulated and not regulated, and EPA's statement that it was going to try to adjust that dividing line over time to get it to the numerical point. And Justice Alito's picked up on a quote that Peter Keisler initiated the argument with, which was that the Congress that enacted the program would find it, quote, unrecognizable if those numerical thresholds were applied as written on the original numbers. And the essence of Justice Alito's question was, well, if it would be unrecognizable with the original numbers and you needed to change the numbers to make it unrecognizable, then EPA, if you're going to regulate down to the original numbers over time, that's going to make it unrecognizable again, and so you're going to exacerbate the problem. That was directed to the Solicitor General of the United States, who I think tried to muddle through as best he could, but particularly for those like me on the other side of the case, I think that did spotlight one of the fundamental tensions in their argument. And then the other question asked by Justice Alito and then picked up on by Chief Justice Roberts was just more straightforward. For the greenhouse gas pollutants, EPA has claimed authority to rewrite the dividing line between regulated and unregulated sources in terms of tons of emissions per year. What other pollutants might they have that authority for? Meaning, is this theory going to get out of hand if we validate in this case? I think, again, the Solicitor General tried to handle that as best he could, saying, well, if presented with another situation that was on along parallel lines to here, they would have authority to rewrite again. But I also thought that Justice Alito was pointing out an important point in the Solicitor General's argument. I thought the another interesting line of questioning, and again, I'm combining from various points in the argument, came from Justice Kennedy. Early on, Justice Kennedy made a reference to the court's 2007 decision in Massachusetts versus EPA, which held that the EPA had authority to regulate greenhouse gases from new motor vehicles, or as a practical matter, probably had that authority, depending on how you read it. And the implication of that question was basically that perhaps the Massachusetts versus EPA precedent would control here. And that was certainly, when that question came out, probably tending more in favor of the Solicitor General's position. On the other hand, later in the argument, again on this issue of precedent and controlling precedent, Judge Kennedy, or Justice Kennedy, asked a question that was more in favor of the petitioner's position, saying that as he read the petitioner's briefs, it became clear to him that the Brown and Williamson case from the Supreme Court was a precedent that was heavily relied on by the petitioners and potentially persuasive. He said that he did not see any similar precedent highlighted and relied on by the Solicitor General, and he asked the Solicitor General what case he would point to. The Solicitor General pointed to a case called Morton versus Ruiz, and then in a follow-up, the Chief Justice asked the Solicitor General if the Morton and Ruiz case, which he had just cited as something very close to the best case for his position, was to be found in the briefing. And the response to that was no, it was not found in the briefing, but it was found in the administrative record below. And then the sort of fifth and final line of questioning that I thought was interesting, part of my top five, was a question fairly late in the argument of the Solicitor General from Justice Sotomayor. And this is one that I think it would benefit all to read on the transcript to see kind of exactly how it came out. But the essence of the question was a hypothetical on the order of supposing, Mr. Solicitor General, that we are not inclined to affirm EPA in all respects, which of the arguments that you've heard would be, you know, your second choice argument, was the essence of the question as I heard it. So obviously you're here to get an affirmance of EPA, an affirmance of the D.C. Circuit affirming EPA, but if I were to tell you that you weren't going to get to that, what's your second preferred choice? And at that point in the argument, I would say the three candidates for second preferred choice that would have been most in the minds of members of the audience would have been as follows. One could have been the theory of Judge Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit below, basically saying that the PSD program sweeps facilities into its ambit based on emissions of NAAQS pollutants, only NAAQS pollutants. Another of the arguments, and I won't go into the technical difference, would be another middle ground argument that gets about the same way that was put forward by one of the petitioners, the ACC petitioner, that is a different legal theory, a distinctly different legal theory, even though it gets to a similar place. But that would have been another sort of middle ground argument. And then the third middle ground argument that a lot of people would have been thinking of would have been perhaps, as is always a possibility in any administrative case, perhaps a correction of an interpretive error to by the Supreme Court with a remand to the D.C. Circuit and some kind of a statement of the limits of the type of deference that Justice Kagan perhaps found interesting. I go over those positions just because the response, and it was really quite surprising of the Solicitor General, was to throw out another alternative position, which would basically be that sources would come into the PSD program based on their emissions of the threshold amounts of pollutants, but just not for carbon dioxide. And so you couldn't get over the hump and into the program based on emissions of carbon dioxide, which is really the pollutant, as the Solicitor General pointed out many times, that creates the problem of extending it to small sources. And I just underscore that because this differentiation between carbon dioxide and the other pollutants was surprising, because this was not mentioned not only in the merits briefing in the Supreme Court, but in the certiorari briefing or in the D.C. Circuit briefing, or even, to my recollection, in the agency proceedings. The agency quite consciously regulated based on what they called an amalgamation of six greenhouse gases based on their global warming potential. And so for purposes of regulatory controls, those six were essentially treated as one pollutant, and it was a unexpected step for me, certainly, to see the Solicitor General, in response to a question, breaking apart that six greenhouse gas amalgamation and proposing what I would call another grounds for EPA not to prevail on, but for EPA to lose on, but sort of a preferred grounds as part of what was a discussion that was at least in part influenced by the question of, if you don't win, how would you like to lose? So the bottom line, I think the bottom line for the Solicitor General would pick up on some of the themes that we talked about today. I think he took care to say that greenhouse gas emissions and global climate change are an urgent problem in the agency's view. It's a very high priority problem in the agency's view. It can't wait to get going or to get addressed down the road. It has to come now, and that the court should recognize that and should recognize, as some of the questions indicated, that EPA is trying to do the best it can in something of an unexpected circumstance. I think the bottom lines for petitioner's side, and I'll just mention a couple of them, were summed up really, really very nicely in the rebuttal argument that was handled by Peter Keisler. He opened by keying off of a line of questioning that had come early, particularly from the Chief Justice, saying that even if you solve the small sources problem, you still have in place under the PSD program regulation that's very particularistic and prescriptive for large sources, down to the proverbial light bulb in the plant cafeteria. And then he went from that into separation of powers problems, the problems with agencies rewriting statutes. He brought the Brown and Williamson case into the discussion, which had been referenced before in some of the question. And I thought those two points on rebuttal nicely summed up our side, the petitioner's side of the case. You know, in terms of predictions going forward, as Abraham Lincoln once said, you know, with high hopes for the future, no predictions are ventured at this point. And so I'd just like to open it up for any questions or any comments that any listeners might have.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. Thank you very much for that excellent summary of the argument. And for those of you on the line, we have over 120 people on the line right now, so we should have plenty of questions and comments coming forth in the next 30 minutes or so. If you have a question or a comment, in a moment we'll turn the floor mode on, and you'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. So if you have a question, again, press star and the pound key. And looks like we've got a couple on the line, and we'll go right to our first one.
Hi, this is David in Cleveland, Ohio. So I just was wondering if there's any challenge to the notion of man-made climate change in oral argument, or did all the parties assume that it was a fact?
I wouldn't go so far as to say assume that it was a fact, but I would say that for purposes of this oral argument, the scientific challenges to global warming were part of a different EPA proceeding and D.C. Circuit review proceeding. The Supreme Court did not grant certiorari on those questions, so they were just not relevant to the question presented, which was obviously approved and slightly rewritten by the Supreme Court. So they form no part of today's argument and presumably will form no part of the opinions the court issues in today's case.
Thanks.
All right, well, our lines are open. So again, if you have a question for Mr. Gassway or a comment, please press star and then the pound key. One quick programming note, our next scheduled Teleform conference call will be this Wednesday, February 26th at 2 p.m. Eastern. It's on the important intellectual property cases at the Supreme Court, Octane Fitness, and Highmark, and that's with Professor Gregory Dolan. Again, that's Wednesday, February 26th at 2 p.m. All right, next, and so we'll move right to our next question.
Yeah, hi, this is Brian Mannix in Virginia. Rob, you didn't mention any discussion of the standing question, and yet in discussing whether the case might be remanded to the D.C. Circuit, it sounds like that would be effectively a reversal of a decision that was made on standing grounds. Any thoughts on that?
Brian, that's an excellent point. Obviously, and let me take a step back for those people who don't know this. There were multiple proceedings before the EPA. One of them was the so-called timing or triggering rule, in which they decided that GHGs were encompassed within the PSD program. And then there was a separate proceeding called the tailoring rule, in which they rewrote the coverage thresholds. And what Brian's referring to is the fact that in the D.C. Circuit, there was a decision that the industry petitioners in states like Texas did not have standing to challenge the tailoring rule. There was little or no discussion of standing in the briefing of the question as reframed by the Supreme Court. And, you know, I'll look at the transcript of argument, but I'd be willing to bet a lot that there was just no discussion of standing in today's oral argument. So I think that we can assume that unless something completely unexpected comes out, that the challenges that the petitioners were putting forward to the rules, both as to the primary argument and as to the fallback argument, are recognized by the court to enjoy standing.
Yep.
Okay, we've got one question currently pending on the line, and after that, our lines will be open. So again, if you have a question or a comment, press star and the pound key.
Rob, this is Sam Kasman, CEI. EPA claimed during argument that humans were not net emitters, and I know Justice Breyer had some fun with having learned that, but that's the first time I've heard that from EPA. Where did they come off? When did that statement originate? Any idea?
I was going to ask you, Sam, because I know that, you know, you talk a lot to climate scientists, certainly more than we do. I don't remember ever seeing that, and I don't. It wasn't clear to me in context what they were talking about. Just for other people, there was an exchange where Justice Breyer was was formulating a hypothetical of a football game with packed stands, and it seemed to be the essence of the hypothetical that when you got so many people into one place, they could become a stationary source subject to regulation under the Clean Air Act because they would all be exhaling carbon dioxide. And not directly, but kind of humorously, the Solicitor General made the comment that humans are not net emitters of carbon dioxide, therefore creating a direct on all fours conflict with my sixth grade science teacher, who said that we breathe in oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide. And there were some more kind of laughter and frivolity about that afterward. But the bottom line to Sam's question is, I don't remember ever seeing that before, and certainly I don't know the science, so I can't comment or I can't speculate on where that statement would have come from. But I do note the disagreement from what I learned in sixth grade science.
Okay.
All right, we've got a couple more questions pending. We'll be able to get to both of those. Again, after that, if you'd like to ask a question of our speaker, it's star and then the pound key.
This is Steve Minnick in Austin. I was wondering, was there much discussion of the issue of going beyond the precedent and looking at how the precedent of rewriting the statute and rule could apply negatively in other contexts? And was there much discussion at that point?
I think on that point, the two most salient exchanges were the ones that I mentioned. It was Justice Alito's question about if you can rewrite the numbers for purposes of GHGs, what about other pollutants? I don't remember any questions that would go beyond the Clean Air Act or even the PSD program and say, well, how would this apply, in another area of law? As I said before, on the issue, on a related issue that's not having to do with rewriting, I think that the question of Justice Kennedy was relevant, where Justice Kennedy said, I understand where the petitioners are coming from. They're saying that because you need to rewrite and tailor and contravene the statute, we should hold that GHGs are not within the PSD program on authority of Brown and Williamson. What's your best statute? And as described by the Solicitor General, it was this Morton versus Ruiz case, which really sounded like it was more of an administrative problem in his view of needing more resources. So that's the two closest things that I can come up with that I heard at the argument today about rewriting statutes and precedents and other contexts. But I think the bottom line is there was not much exploration beyond that.
Thank you.
All right, we've got two more questions to get to, and then our lines will be open.
Hello, Rob. This is Jack McMacken. Thank you for that very good summary. I sat there this morning, and it's clearer to me now than it certainly was sitting there. And thanks for the excellent joint brief you took the lead on. Here's really a question. I was wondering what you thought about. When Justice Kagan talked about the apex of Chevron deference, one of the unusual things about this case is that the agency wasn't claiming that it was regulating greenhouse gases under this prescriptive PSD program under Chevron deference, under Step 2. Their position was they didn't have any choice, that it was a Chevron 1 command, kind of all commingled with Mass v. EPA. I thought probably she had in mind that maybe the deference went to the rolling rewriting of the thresholds. But it seems to me there's a broader issue there that maybe could emerge on the court of Well, if we think that this is a matter of Chevron deference and the agency didn't exercise a choice or a judgment, and maybe they never would, maybe they would decide to proceed on some of those other sections of the Act that received a lot of discussion today, that we could get a remand for the agency to think all this through again, including whether they want to, if they know they have discretion not to, proceed under PSD. What do you think about that, Rob?
Well, obviously it's hard to read what Justice Kagan was thinking, but I think what you're saying could well be what she or others on the court might think. And let me just say it this way. There's a D.C. Circuit precedent called the Prill case that says if you misinterpret the scope of your authority, that's an agency error, I'll call it, in and of itself, without going beyond that. And so under this theory or line of cases, the remedy for that would be to say, we're telling you, in this case EPA, that you weren't forced by Mass v. EPA or the PSD statutes into this box that you perceived yourself in as an interpretive matter. So now that you're not in this box, we're going to remand to you for you to decide what to do without necessarily telling you what you can or cannot do. So don't think that you're penned in. Recognize that your interpretive authority may be broader, but now you tell us where you come out. And without speculating on what she was thinking, I think that certainly ran through my mind that she might be thinking of something like that. And that's why I listed the remand possibility as another of the menu of options, of sort of middle ground options, along with something along the lines of the ACC argument and something along the lines of the Kavanaugh dissent below. Is that how you thought about it, Jack?
It looks like we lost him. I think the system may have cut him out. We do have one more question on the line, and then if any of the callers who were on earlier want to comment again, our lines are open after this next question. So we again, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, Rob. This is Jim Wallace in Sarasota, Florida. I have a
Jim.
Hi. Good to talk to you again. I have a quick question for you. As you can imagine, the scientists that have been associated with this case for a long, long time are following it closely. And one of the questions that they're going to definitely be asking me is, what's the worst case for EPA here? Do I read you properly that the worst case for EPA is that they lose the ability to use the permitting process to regulate stationary sources with respect to CO2, but will still be able to set basically any standard they like for coal plants, natural gas plants, and so forth?
Yeah, that's a key question. And let me just reframe it so everybody understands what we're talking about. We're talking about two different provisions of the Clean Air Act. One is the PSD provision, which involves case-by-case permitting for large facilities. The other is the so-called New Source Performance Standard provision of Section 111 of the Act. And it's important to realize, as I said at the outset of the call, this case is really what I would call the PSD applicability case. And it's very clear from the arguments this morning that the worst case, as Mr. Wallace puts it, for EPA, is that they lose the ability to enforce emissions controls on GHG pollutants from stationary sources under the PSD, the Prevention of Significant Deterioration program of Title I of the Clean Air Act. And obviously, you know, every case in the Supreme Court has precedence and effects on future cases, but that other authority, the NSPS authority, and the ongoing rulemakings that EPA is engaged in right now just aren't a part of this particular case.
That's what I thought you were. That's what I thought you were going to say. I would just comment for those lawyers on the phone that might be interested. There are a number of amicus briefs that have been written and submitted on the status of the science, and there's a piece that Buddy Menton, who may be on the phone now, submitted that deals with the social cost of carbon. That I think will be posted sometime today on what's up with that. That I know a lot of you who are following this science tend to look at. I would think that if you're interested at all in the science, take a look at those, because it's really too bad that we got to where we are relative to the science story, because this is going to come out to be just a, it's going to be very clear to all over the course of the next couple of years that EPA's got nothing when it comes to the science story. They're in deep trouble, and it's a shame that we're not able to get that message to this court.
All right, looks like we have one more question pending, and then our lines will be open. So again, if you've got a question or a comment for the first or second time, feel free to call in by pressing star and then the pound key.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS, and I've got a question if there's any place in the written arguments where there's a requirement to capitalize all costs of use and restoration to like condition to maintain the balance of nature as part of our constitutional duty to the liberty of posterity. Thanks.
Wow. You know, I don't want to comment on that. I don't know if that's I'm not exactly sure where that question is coming from, but the one thing I could say is I haven't thought about it, and certainly in the briefing of this case, that issue didn't come up.
Okay. Well, it comes from basically I'm a military guy, and at some point in time when laws break down, you guys turn things back over to the rules of war to figure out how we rewrite laws. And as pressure comes in on balancing, if we capitalize all costs, we wouldn't be in this problem. That's where it comes from.
Well, I'm not sure I understand understand the question. I can say this, in terms of an agency rewriting of an enactment of Congress, certainly the debate was carried out much more on a conventional plane of delegations of administrative authority and the Supreme Court's usual practice for interpreting the breadth and scope of those delegations. It sounds like you're making a very fundamental argument here, and that just wasn't the plane at which the discussion went, either in the written briefs that you mentioned or in the oral argument this morning at the court.
Yeah, we're getting ready to sue over post-roads requirements, restrictions. It's why we're thinking about fundamental things. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this is Christian Corgan again. Our lines are open, so in the last few minutes here, if you have a question or a comment on the case, please press star and then the pound key. A couple other programming notes. In addition to our next conference call on Wednesday, February 26th at 2 p.m. on the intellectual property cases at the Supreme Court, we've also set the date for our second annual Executive Branch Review Conference. That's going to be Wednesday, May 7th of this year at the Mayflower Hotel. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, for details on registration. Again, that's Wednesday, May 7th at the Mayflower Hotel here in Washington, D.C. And it looks like we've exhausted our questions. I want to thank, first of all, I want to thank all of our audience today for calling in. We had over 120 people on the call. And most importantly, I want to thank Mr. Robert Gassaway, who took the time out of his day to not only attend the argument, but also to share his thoughts with all of us on the call. A reminder that this call will be posted as a podcast in the future. So if you want to listen to it again or share it with friends and colleagues and associates, it will be available on our website shortly. Mr. Gassaway, again, from all of us, thanks so much for being on the call, and we very much appreciated having you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to do it, and I really appreciate the invitation, Christian. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Fantastic. Well, until next time, on Wednesday, February 26th at 2 p.m., we are adjourned. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.